The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So welcome. You know, these days, sometimes I have this sense to speak about anything but grief feels like an empathic failure, you know. And sometimes that grief feels like the grief required to have a good death, and sometimes that grief feels like the grief required to catalyze something in our hearts about care, about compassion. And so that is occupying my mind quite a bit. And I feel like one of the blessings of Dharma practice, and what I was alluding to in the sit, was that something about the practice that leads the heart to be more malleable and to enter and exit states of poignancy and delight and heaviness and lightness, to enter and exit that more with more and more fluidity and ease. And so there are a million reasons to grieve, and that's real. And there are a lot of facets of being human, and there are a lot of facets of this moment. And want to try to reflect the kind of many faceted nature of the present. And so Jesus said to those who had believed him, "If you abide in my word, you are my true disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." Yeah. That's John chapter 8, verse 31. And the question, will the truth set you free? Is the truth in our beliefs? Is it in our bones? How do we think about this? And the liberating power of truth is, of course, a major theme in Dharma teachings. That one way that teachers frame the path of liberation is knowing the Dharma. In knowing the Dharma, we know truth, and seeing truth, we are liberated. That's a kind of major framework. And from this view, avijja, the ignorance, is the wellspring of our difficulties. So in Samyutta Nikaya, ignorance is the leader in the attainment of unskillful qualities, followed by a lack of conscience and a lack of moral concern. In an unknowledgeable person immersed in ignorance, wrong view arises. In one of wrong view, wrong intention. In one of wrong intention, wrong speech, wrong action, wrong livelihood, wrong effort, wrong mindfulness. In one of wrong mindfulness, wrong concentration arises. Right? And so here we have a picture where suffering is a function of not seeing the truth. And the antidote, of course, is a knowledge and vision of things as they really are. Now, I've always had a certain kind of ambivalence about this formulation. You know, I'm not a philosopher, but I've read enough philosophy, East, West, to know that capital T truth is tricky business. Yeah, when you start to get into the weeds of that, it gets, as a lot of debates, a lot of complexity, and I just emerge from that feeling a measure of humility. This is the philosopher Richard Rorty. The reason for thinking that there will be no last philosophy is simply that no answer can fail to be an answer to a question, and no question can guarantee its own permanent relevance. Yeah, no question can guarantee its own permanent relevance. And it's interesting to consider how the questions that Dharma practice is trying to answer have evolved over the course of history. Yeah, that Dharma is trying to answer a question or questions. And how have those questions evolved over the course of 2,600 years? So as a Dharma teacher, I don't proclaim access to capital T truth. That as a guiding metaphor is misses something for me. But I do want to talk about honesty. We may not know the final truth, but we know the difference between honesty and deception. We can discern the small t truth, and we find actually that small t truth, that is actually enough to free our heart in important ways. In a way, our path begins with a very honest reflection. This path of seeking the Dharma heart, it begins with a very honest reflection, namely a realization of this isn't going to work out. Yeah. The way at least I've been doing it, this isn't going to work out. We have that intuition. And so we begin the spiritual kind of quest with this very honest reflection of happiness, well-being, it's complicated. And the way we generally go about engineering it has problems. And so we begin to practice, and we make a commitment to looking deeply. Yeah, what is it actually like to be human? That is a deceptively simple question, and we might think we would know the answer to that. What's it actually like to be human? But we have to look to see. We have to look carefully, deeply, in a sustained way, from a mind that is settled. We may not know capital T truth, but there is a commitment to honesty and to not rationalizing one's life and preferences. It is possible to live Yeah, to live in essentially marshaling delusion to paper over greed and aversion. Yeah. Rationalization. Delusion, it works with staggering speed, you know, and the hallmark of ego is defensiveness. And so the work of delusion is to actually dignify greed and aversion. And that process happens quickly and it leaves almost no trace. And part of what we get good at in our spiritual practice is discerning the trace of rationalization, the trace of self-deception. We may not know the final truth, but we can indeed move against the tides of self-deception. And so we gather our courage. We gather our courage because revelation is not comfortable. It actually does not promise consolation. It does not promise consolation. And yeah, my sense is that the awakening of the heart actually deepens certain kinds of pain. Yeah. Now, over the course of my practice, I have cycled through many, many different intentions, you know, like what feels like it's animating my practice. And I've tended to start small. We start small, yeah, when we practice. It's like an accoutrement of our life, yeah. And so the habit is to, you know, essentially for me to like nestle the Dharma into the infrastructure of my neurosis. Yeah. Does that sound familiar to anybody? It's like, we kind of just like, well, we'll just sort of wedge it in kind of here and it's gonna, you know, it'll just sort of live in this little compartment, right? And then I can continue, you know, to let the momentum of my neurosis shape my life, but the Dharma won't stay compartmentalized for long with sincerity. So there the intentions evolve. It becomes maybe less self-involved, more dedicated to alleviating the suffering of others. Sometimes we don't even know why we're practicing for a long time. I didn't really know why I was practicing. I just knew there was something essential about it. But over all of these years, what I fall back on most, the intention that in a sense I trust above all else, is the intention towards curiosity, yeah, towards looking itself. Philosopher James called curiosity the impulse towards better cognition. And curiosity is distinctive because it really doesn't have an agenda. It's not the instrument of something else. It's just like, we just want to look. And this turns out to be very conducive to growth. The kind of hunger to keep seeing becomes very alive, and maybe you can remember times in practice, maybe that time is now, maybe there's time in retreat when the looking itself, the curiosity, the kind of wonder of seeing, the wonder of awareness was just fully satiated. It was not a transaction at all. And in these times, we come to care more about awareness than what we call our life. And the tides of pleasure and pain and hope and fear and gain and loss, all of this kind of recedes into the background. And even the very longing for freedom recedes into the background. And this kind of this like longing for a certain kind of honesty with what is here to see, this is the centerpiece of one's heart. Ajahn Chah said, everything is teaching us. Everything is teaching us. And I remember Gil one time saying, this is not mindfulness. Maybe we shouldn't call it mindfulness practice. We should call it honesty practice. Yeah, just to be honest. This spirit of honesty, of doing what we can not to deceive oneself or others, this kind of commitment to to honesty. It runs very deep in the path. It's really quite foundational. And we commit to looking because, as the Buddha suggests, like our default is delusion rather than clarity. Our default is delusion. We can think about it like, from a kind of modern evolutionary perspective, like pristine clarity was not at the top of evolution's to-do list. Yeah. Groupthink, conformity, fitting in, is probably more evolutionarily advantageous than the kind of maverick view of this like radical honesty. An evolutionary psychologist, Marty Heselton, she writes, on the surface, cognitive biases appear to be puzzling when viewed through an evolutionary lens because they depart from standards of logic and accuracy. They appear to be design flaws instead of examples of good engineering. To the evolutionary psychologist, however, the task is not whether the cognitive feature is accurate, but rather how well it solves a particular problem and how solving this problem contributed to fitness ancestrally. Viewed in this way, if a cognitive bias positively impacted fitness, it is not a design flaw, it is a design feature. Some genuine cognitive biases might be functional features designed by the wisdom of natural selection. The Buddhist path, it's very radical. It's very radical. It's really not aimed towards self-preservation. It takes us against the stream. Yeah. The reality of our own mortality, the pressures associated with that can have profoundly distorting effects on how we see. So the Buddha said, delusion is the default. We do not see the three marks of existence, the three characteristics, dukkha, anicca, anatta. We see the three not characteristics. Yeah? We see, you know, we have fantasies about a durable pleasure. Yeah? That might structure, that structures our lives. We fantasize about tying up all the loose ends of being human and holding the world still, of really gaming out samsara, of managing uncertainty. We fantasize about taking refuge in an identity. We fantasize about possession and control. And there's an innocence in all of these fantasies, but we have to look with a kind of, yeah, care, honesty, attention. So we look, no, it's dukkha, anicca, anatta, it's unsatisfactoriness, it's uncertainty, impermanence, the centerlessness of being. And 2020 is mercilessly pounding this into us. Yeah. And I take this as a kind of invitation to learn, because the structure of insight is that it's multi-layered. It can always penetrate more deeply into our bones. Had a Tibetan teacher, mentor, said something like, trust your experience, but refine your view. Yeah, trust your experience, but refine your view. And so here in saying, well, there's still so much delusion, like we're not trying to doubt everything we experience. Yeah, we're not trying to doubt the truth of this moment. What's here? Yes, that was the experience. And at the same time, the view can be refined. The view can be refined. Wise view and perception interact. And so in a way, it's like, I want to say, I vow to explore my view. I vow to do what I can to step out of self-deception. And so part of honesty, part of this commitment to truthfulness is acknowledging how easy it is to pull a fast one on ourselves. It said, I think it was Tanya Lombroso, she said something like, people tend to believe that they think like scientists, but they actually think like trial lawyers. Yeah. Not disparaging the beloved attorneys in the Sangha, no offense intended, but what she meant was like, do we form our view by accumulating evidence and then doing our best to synthesize it and arrive at a conclusion? Or do we begin with a conclusion and then select and marshal evidence to support that conclusion? Yeah. And we probably do more lawyering than blinded experimentation, yeah, yeah, where you're gathering evidence in the most honest way we can, yeah. And just knowing this is actually, it's not intended to like ignite doubt in us, but we want to be open to the possibility that some portion of our lives is really, and that some portion of our philosophy of life is a kind of rationalization of our conditioning and our preferences. Yeah. Sometimes we see this, we actually see that we can build like enormous whole moral, political philosophies, you know, like our entire idea of what is, what should be, is just a river into which our kilesas flow. Yeah. The defilements just flow into that, just animate, give that philosophy body, give it life. Empty, empty, empty. This world making, this building, yeah, empty. Truthfulness, non-deceptiveness, transparency. This is, we want to consider the realm of secrecy in our lives. Freud said something like, human beings are the animals that keep secrets. Elsewhere it said like, we're not what we think, we are what we hide. Now, secrecy is not the same as privacy, right? It may or may not be important to share. There are safety considerations. Just this morning I was reading about a biography of a gay man and the meaning of secrecy, transparency, safety is very different for some versus others. And so we want to be sensitive to that. But the kind of secrets that I'm pointing to is that which we hide from others, but also kind of hide from ourselves. And sometimes there can be this kind of dance of denial and revelation. Yeah, maybe you even can feel into that. Like, oh, this is real. No, it's not. Oh, I may have a problem. No, I don't. And this kind of, this dance, yeah? This dance where we're not even sure what what is real for us. But there's a burden. There's a burden in this dance. There's a burden in holding secrets, which are often encased in a certain kind of shame. And those secrets, they to hold a secret, secrecy is an active process, yeah? One of the researchers on thought suppression, yeah, says exactly that. This is Wegner. Secrecy is an active process as it requires much deliberate behavioral and mental work. The cognitive maneuvers necessary for keeping a secret create an intentional suppression of the secret thought, the consequence of which is a preoccupation with the secret itself. Yeah. There's an anxiety in being, maybe we might be found out. And more and more we can sense that longing to live our lives such that we're not afraid of being found out. And so we look for where we are deceptive. Psychologist Bella DiPaolo, she writes, occasionally people tell lies in pursuit of material gain, personal convenience, or to escape from punishment. Much more commonly, however, the rewards that are sought are psychological ones. We lie to make ourselves appear more sophisticated or more virtuous than we think our true characteristics warrant. We lie to protect ourselves and sometimes others from disapproval and disagreements or from getting our feelings hurt. The realm of lying, then, is one in which identities are claimed and impressions are managed. Our secrecy shines a kind of light on the architecture of self. Yeah. Because secrets, deceptiveness, often involves a measure of shame. And shame is often the trace of self-view. We can learn about who we think we are, about what we think makes us worthy or unworthy. We can learn about the architecture of self-view. Yeah, shame helps illuminate the moralism in our view. Yeah, I was alluding to the innocence of experience. And in shame, nothing is innocent. Yeah, nothing is innocent. And so we come to digest our secrets, to begin to live with more transparency, to diffuse the shame that encased some of our secrecy. And we might still be private, but the world no longer reminds us of our secrets. I want to unfold, Rilke says. I don't want to be folded anywhere, because where I am folded, there I am a lie. Part of why I teach Dharma is that here, yeah, with people like you, I don't feel ashamed of what I care about. Yeah, I can actually express my heart. This is the kind of intrapersonal dimension, but there's effects on our interpersonal life, non-deceptiveness, truthfulness. In a way, our ability to trust others depends on the congruence between their explicit words and their affect, their body. Yeah, like, yeah, these become more overlapping. Yeah, we find ways of our inner life and our words cohere more closely. There's sense of transparency, of non-deceptiveness. And truthfulness has a really kind of honored place in the Buddhist tradition. When we deceive others, we take active part in deluding them. Yeah? We take active part in deluding them. We foster a deluded view for them. And then they have to live with that delusion, or they have to live with that confusion about maybe I've been deceived and maybe not. They have to try to discern that. And then that delusion, or the potential, yeah, for their delusion that we have levied upon them can shape their life in ways. And so it's been said that to deceive another it's really a kind of attack upon the autonomy of those receiving our lie. Yeah, we actually constrain their freedom in inducing a measure of delusion. And conversely, like, we support the freedom of the other by being honest, by speaking the truth. Yeah. We may not know that we may not have our last philosophy, capital T, truth, but we do know what honesty is. We commit to looking deeply. Yeah. To looking deeply, to finding new ways of looking. We strive for honesty with ourselves. To take a stand against self-deception, honesty about the human condition, honesty about ourselves, honesty about our relationships. And we hold the permanent possibility of being wrong, not as a way of inducing doubt or indecision or paralysis or anything like this, but as a way of supporting the looking. Yeah. We never know when delusion's had its last word. And that willingness to be wrong feels more and more like a kind of something like an ethical commitment. Yeah, I vow. Yeah, a kind of vow. Yeah, because the unwillingness to be wrong, the unwillingness to step out of self-deception, guarantees a measure of fragility and defensiveness. And the humility of all of this, the humility, it makes us more careful, more gentle. Yeah. More careful about hurting someone on the basis of our ideas. The humility makes us more careful. So I vow to strive on with honesty. Let's just sit for a moment.